Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on a novel that explores the myths and memories of Cuba. Derek Palacio's debut novel is filled with a sensual longing for Cuba, its tastes and sounds and sights. But until last month, he had never been to the island that looms so large in his family heritage. Today, as Cuba observes days of mourning for the passing of Fidel Castro, we'll talk about what our guest's first ever experience was like there, and perhaps you have something to contribute as well. If you've been to Cuba, I'd be interested in hearing about a singular moment that gave you some insight into its rich history and culture. Now, not the sightseeing, which is magnificent, I know, but this is really more asking you for a moment that led to some deeper understanding. Maybe it was an interaction with a driver in Cuba. Maybe you went to a birthday party or something. Maybe you struck up a conversation with someone at a hotel who lives in Cuba. What kind of insight did you get from that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Derek Palacio is a writer and a teacher and co-director of the Mojave School, which is a creative writing workshop in Nevada. His debut novel is titled The Mortifications, and he's with us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Derek, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show on this day, I have to say.
Thanks very much for having me.
Have you heard from some friends and family members about their reaction to Fidel Castro's death?
I haven't had a chance to touch base with my dad about Castro's passing yet. He's the one in our family who's from Cuba. But I was in Miami a couple weeks ago for the Miami Book Fair, and I got to speak with my uncle and my aunt there and just talking about Cuba and possibly going back. So that was sort of surreal having been there not long ago and talking about that, maybe a future trip with them, and then now this past Friday hearing the news.
Your father was he 5 years old, is that right, when the family left Cuba?
He was about five and a half, yep.
And how, tell me a little bit about your family's history on the island.
So the majority of my father's family left in 56, so he was five, and they came to Miami like most Cubans at that time, or a great deal of Cubans at that time. And since then, they took one family trip back in 1960, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then since then, no one outside of one of his brothers has returned to the island.
Well, why not?
You know, I think a variety of reasons. I think, you know, certainly from my father's perspective, he grew up in Miami. He doesn't really remember much of the island. And it's sort of he has sort of some fragments of memories of the East and the sugarcane plantations that his family owned out there. But, you know, his experience is it's pretty ethereal. So I think for him, the pull is not so large. But then for his brothers who are older than him, they're about 10, 11 years older than him. The one who went back, you know, he married a woman, a Cuban woman, and they went and lived in the island, you know, all the way up through the special period before he came to Miami for good. But my other uncle hasn't been back since. And I think, you know, some of that has to do with, you know, not feeling like you want to see Cuba and what has happened to it and the changes that have transpired after the revolution. And then some of it is maybe just feeling sort of ambiguous about just having left your homeland.
Okay, so that's really interesting what you said about not wanting to see what's happened. I mean, in some ways, he wanted to preserve his image of a place that's really important to him and I guess not witness its deterioration.
Sure, and I should say, so my uncle, the one I was speaking, my oldest uncle, he is curious about going back, and I think he feels, you know, that the land that my family owned in Cuba is the same, and he could see that land, and he could have an experience of that land. But my aunt, for instance, she was from outside of Havana, and, you know, I think she knows, you know, through other people she knows, other people have gone back, the news of Cuba, just the sort of state that city and that area of the country is in. And I think it would be, you know, pretty devastating to go back and see some place that you left in a sort of, not necessarily splendor, but, in a good state and then to return and see it sort of deteriorated in ways that, I mean, you can't even imagine. So I think that that is a difficult thing.
You took a birthright trip. Is that right, in October?
Yeah, that's correct. I was really lucky. I was accepted into a Cuba trip program called Tu Cuba by the Cuba One Foundation, which is brand new. And it's sort of modeled after the Israel Birthright Program. And they just – their only goal is in groups of 10, they take first and second generation Cuban Americans to see the island for the first time. And I was lucky to be amongst the last group that went.
So you said on the eve of the trip, it's the feeling of being drawn in by a place but not recognizing it. So now that you've been, does your real experience square with how you thought it would be?
Yeah, I would say it is, and I think I maybe assumed that this would happen, that my real experience is so much bigger and broader and encompasses so many more elements than what I imagined or read or researched about Cuba. You know, the reality of the island is much bigger than anything I could have imagined in my mind. So that was certainly – it was an overwhelming trip in that way.
But, I mean, I guess the question for you is you'd build up a kind of mythology about Cuba, mm-hmm. some from the family lore, right,
mm-hmm.
of
yep.
what it was like. I'm sure with other people kind of shaping that for you. You'd written that into this novel. And then when the novel – what was the novel – the novel had already been out when you –
It had, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So – and then only then do you see – this real place that you've mythologized for a long time. So I want to know how that meets, what that was like.
Sure. You know, I should say because of the way my father described Cuba to us through sort of these memories, and then also because my family, my brother and my sister and my mother and my father and I grew up in mostly New Hampshire, you know, even well outside of sort of more familiar Cuban areas in the United States, there was a great deal of mythologizing, I think, that had already happened before I ever sat down to write about Cuba, you know. It felt very distant and very far away. So that was sort of an impression of the island that I was working from and trying to move through when I was writing the book. But getting there and seeing it, you know, there were plenty of elements of the island that seemed reminiscent of both the Cuba that my father had experienced and that I knew from his family, and then elements of the Cuba that I was trying to engage with in the novel. You know, there are definitely certain parts about the island that I, you know, did not cover or did not touch upon. And even now, I mean, the book is set in 1980, so we're almost 40 years away from when the novel is set. So even the Cuba of the book that I wrote, it doesn't even exist. You know, that doesn't exist anymore either.
See, I think of your novel, which I loved, as having this kind of magical element to it. I'm not saying magical realism. I want you to know that. I'm
sure.
Saying it had this this kind of larger than life, really vivid quality to it. And part of that, I guess, is, you know, entering into the mythology that you were channeling as you were writing it. Then what happens when you get there and you kind of see mm-hmm. the day-to-day life and you see what's happened to the people that live there? What happens when those two things meet?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that idea of magical realism and whether this book does or does not do that. And some people have described it that way and others haven't. And I think the best thing I've come up with in regards to that idea is you know, magical realism tries to use the style and aesthetics of realism to make magical things seem possible and tangible. And I think for me, when I was writing this book, maybe to some degree also unconsciously, I was writing in a style that was meant to elevate a very real concrete world and make it feel magical, even if there are no magical elements in it, because that sort of matched the idea I had of the island. And so getting there and seeing it and experiencing it, you know, it's a direction that I've been trying to move in for a long time. I've been trying to get a handle on the reality of Cuba and what it is like for people who live there now, and what all the history has led up to. So going there was, you know, I was certainly anxious and nervous that maybe the book had totally gotten things wrong, or I had completely misrepresented at least one experience of Cuba. But it was more like I was just gifted an opportunity to see all the many different other ways that Cuba has developed outside of this one particular very rural, very agrarian experience that I write about.
You know, I actually didn't know that there was a debate about whether your novel was magical realism or not. And here's the thing. I don't want to be the journalist that every time I talk with a writer about somewhere in Latin America, we have to talk about magical realism, you know?
Sure.
So that's why I hesitated to kind of bring it up. But you've kind of given me some insight.
Okay, yeah.
A call here from Carrie in Woodbury. Hey, Carrie, it sounds like you've been to Cuba recently.
Yes, that's right. Actually, it's Gary.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, that's a problem. I was there in October, just actually the day that Hurricane Matthew hit, I landed.
Oh, wow. Hmm. What was the trip like?
Well, it was incredible. I mean, it was a church group. We were three of us there doing a site visit for one of the churches there in central Cuba. And what I was telling the other person was the interest in America is very tangible. They're very knowledgeable on the United States politics, very educated. I'd say about 98% were literate, and that was from the young to the old, and very much, I would say, anti-Castro. Almost everybody was like, okay, this is enough. We're ready to go on.
That was the experience I had too, Gary, in talking with people that one of the people that I had a conversation with, and a really candid one, said that Castro forced every family into an impossible choice. You know, stay and watch your children's lives be limited under that oppressive government, or watch your children move away to the U.S. and, you know, be a distant part of their lives. Derek, is that something that perhaps you talked about with some of the people you met in Cuba?
Yeah, one of the questions and things that I was really curious about was sort of what has happened to some of those institutions from the early days of the revolution, like the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, which is sort of that neighborhood watch group that was supposed to be sort of an information network. And I asked her, it was towards the end of the trip when I felt like it was okay to start asking some deeper questions of our tour guide. And she was very wonderful, but she just sort of said, the younger generation thinks it's, it's like a club for the folks, the older folks, and they participate in it because it has some meaning for them still, but it's not something we're interested in. The people I spoke to in Cuba, so our tour guide, we got to meet with some journalists in Cuba. You can hear sort of a desire to move in a different direction, but they're also, I think, very careful and cautious about what that may or may not mean for their country and their people. And so nobody, at least nobody I crossed, was aggressively championing one cause. But there was sort of a careful optimism that they were expressing.
Do you think some of that, as a journalist, this is something I was constantly kind of testing, is do you think that carefulness and caution is, because you're having maybe perhaps an open conversation with a tour guide, is because of the awareness that you really couldn't usually say what you thought in the kind of society. And then you get this is why this conversation with this driver in a car with two other people, just us, I felt like was probably more real than even what the guides were telling us.
Yeah, that's a really hard, that's a hard...
It's hard to say.
Sort of line to parse there, I think. And I never, I'll say this, I never, with all the people that we met, and we met some folks in settings I would say were probably very secure and very safe in terms of being able to have sort of a free and open dialogue. But even outside of those, I didn't feel anybody was offering me a half-truth or a guided truth. I think the Cubans they knew how to talk about their country in a way that expressed, again, all those sort of varieties of responses. Both there are some things that we're going to hold on to, at least for a while, because of the government and the way the system is set up, but then there are also things that people are pushing for that we're making progress on.
Derek Palacio is with us. If you've just tuned in, we're talking with him about his new novel, The Mortifications. You can read about it on the thread, but as it happens, he has some family heritage connected to Cuba. And, of course, with the news over the weekend, we're talking a bit about his first experience in Cuba in October. Derek, do you think you'll be back? You'll go back to Cuba fairly soon or not?
I would like to, yeah. I'd like to get back in the next year. The trip I got to take, we went to Trinidad and Santa Clara and Havana, but my family is from out east by Holguín and Puerto Padre. So those are areas that I'm itching to get back to.
I mentioned in the introduction that you've written in this, what I think of as this real sensuality of the experience of Cuba, and it's, you know, it felt tactile and colorful and vivid to me. And again, that's how I think of where your imagination takes you about a place. So how'd that square with really being there? Because there's a lot of places in Cuba that I think live up to that, but there's plenty of places that don't.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, it was sort of, I mean, it's like that scene from Wizard and the Oz. You know, I think my book is in black and white, and then you go to Cuba and
do you?
You know, the whole world turns into
Technicolor. I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit.
we began the tour in Trinidad, and which is this sort of beautiful old Spanish colonial town, and you can, you know, you could see the sort of the old architecture. You could see sort of the way the city had been set up, and it was in the mountains. And we went to visit sugarcane fields there. But then, you know, 2 days later, we take a two-hour drive and we're in Havana, which was so much bigger and pulsing and widespread than I think I had imagined. So, you know, I think my experience of Cuba was very much of the senses, you know, the smells, the sights, the sounds. But again, just so overwhelming and so big.
Can I ask you this question, just given what you've just said about
sure.
if you were, let's say the novel was in draft form and it hadn't yet been published, would you be mm-hmm. tempted to go back into some of these beautiful descriptions that you have about these memories of Cuba and the mythology of Cuba? Would you go back in and tinker with them, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely.
Would you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think, you know, my position on the book has become, now that I've gone to Cuba, is I wouldn't say I got Cuba right. I think that's a nearly impossible task, considering, again, how wide and diverse it is. But I feel comfortable saying I didn't necessarily get it wrong. And if I did err, it was hopefully without abusing. But at the same time, you know, there are scenes in, you know, having been to Havana, that scene later in the book where the young son returns through Havana, I think, mm-hmm. I would write that differently, or I would think about the different ways my experience should influence that text. But then also, again, like I said earlier, you know, this book takes place almost 40 years ago is when it's set. So I'm not even sure if that would be helpful exercise to try to match the Cuba now with the Cuba then.
I know. You know, when I hear you say I got Cuba right or wrong, that's really not what my question was, because.
Oh, sure.
Well, I didn't want you to think I was saying, so, you know, what would
oh,
you
no,
change
not at
that
all.
Ended up not being
no,
right?
No.
I'm thinking that I loved drifting with you in your imagination, and that's what a novel is. I'm ready to mm-hmm. believe what you've enveloped me in, that this sensual experience of this novel. I guess mm-hmm. I just wondered if there were some moments that you experienced that you thought I could have even my imagination could have grabbed onto that and I could have used that in you know what I'm saying?
I do, yeah. You know, a good example of that might be one of the things that we noticed when we were driving across the island. We took a hired cab across between the cities, just how people have to walk great distances and how mm-hmm. the public transportation is not very reliable, and it doesn't go to all the places people need it to go. And so even at night, even when it's pitch black out and we're on these sort of these windy mountain roads, I remember the night we were driving from Trinidad, you know, you'd come around a corner and the headlights of the taxi cab would flash and there would just be, you know, two or three people walking along the road in the pitch black. You know, the question of where are you going and, what, you know, how long, much further do you have to walk? I don't remember the last time we saw a town. And so there's something about that, I think, you know, the movement on the island was so interesting, and seeing the way the lengths people have to go to get from place to place. There's something very dramatic about that, especially when you pair it with the way the Cuban landscape, you know, Havana is, you know, this beautiful port city. And then, you know, as you move east, the land starts to change. You go through some swampland, but then there's also the mountains start to rise. You know, one of my characters takes that trip across Cuba from Havana out to the east. And I think that would have been something I would have liked to maybe work in a little bit.
I love that example because we experience that too. All of a sudden, the headlights will, this flash of color, you know, some dress mm-hmm. that somebody's wearing or something that they're carrying,
sure.
where it's black and then you'll have this kind of vivid flash of color and then it's gone. As you
yeah.
go by. That is dramatic.
Yeah.
yeah. I didn't think of it that way. You're also asking some questions about what faith is and if you have to suffer for your religious faith. Did you grow up Catholic?
I did, yeah. And I somehow ended up going through Catholic school all the way through college.
You
so
did? Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what? How does that inform the questions that you were asking about that in the novel?
You know, I think there was something very powerful, and maybe this will also lead, there's some Greek mythical allusions in the book too, but there was something about the questions of just faith in general and, you know, believing against, in some cases, you know, rational logic or what might seem like your best interest in higher powers and callings that seemed to really... Once that paired with the idea, you know, this idea of Cuba and thinking about a Cuba and thinking about a mythical Cuba and wanting to hold on to it, I think those two things spoke to each other in ways that were very helpful for the book.
One of your characters, Isabel, spends some time in a convent and then she returns to Cuba and she has some mm-hmm. experiences that you would not guess that somebody who spent some time in a convent would have. I felt like, tell me if this is not true. I felt like you were asking what faith looks like in a vacuum and then what it looks like in the real world.
Yeah, I think that was certainly one of her questions throughout the novel. You know, I mean, when she's in the United States, sort of her faith in Cuba, because they live in Hartford and in New England and are not, you know, surrounded by Cubans, it's sort of that faith has to live in a vacuum. And then when she gets to Cuba and she's separated from, you know, the convent and the formal institutions of her Catholic religion, you know, she builds her own chapel at the campsite where she finds her father after so many years. And she has to, she doesn't have a Bible. She starts trying to write one down from memory. So there's that, you know, in both cases with Cuba and with religion, there was sort of that weird tension of when it's just up to you or when that the formal elements of those beliefs are given to you or entrusted to you. How do you hold on to them? How do you make them permanent or can you make them permanent? And what does that struggle look like?
You know, I thought a lot about what it would mean to write a Bible from memory and try to isolate, you know, modern philosophy, right? Contemporary thinking from how much time did you spend thinking about what that exercise would be like?
You know, I think for me, I mostly was thinking about sort of the desperation you would feel, especially for Isabel. You know, one of the reasons she goes back to find her father is because they have this sort of religious kinship that has been driving her for her entire life. Seeing him out there in Cuba and seeing the state he's in, which is not a good state, and seeing sort of this odd visual of sort of the end of things, I think would stir a kind of desperation in a person. And so, you know, the way I think as I remember writing it, you know, she writes down the books of the Bible as she recalls them and doesn't worry about order and she doesn't worry about, you know, what she writes them down on, that, you know, it's sort of like, oh, I suddenly am feeling this world slip away from me. And now is not the time to think about how it should be structured, but just to hold on to whatever I can, whatever's left.
You know, one of the things that I wondered about in Cuba was how religious faith existed with, you know, the socialism, whatever this government was that Castro was leading. Did you get some insight on that when you were there?
No, you know, we visited a couple of churches that were famous in Havana, but I didn't have a chance to go participate in a mass or to speak with any of the religious folk. I know that at least from my reading, you know, Cuba and the Catholic Church have been at odds at certain points, but the feeling I got, it was present, but not because of its position against the government, or
right.
In some ways it was not, you know, not looked highly upon or not supported. It was sort of up to the people to sort of sustain those faiths.
I mean, it's an odd thing, isn't it? That, I mean, mm-hmm. Castro met with the Pope. It's the kind of thing mm-hmm. that kind of an oppressive government was wary about, but he didn't eliminate it on the island, right? People could
yeah.
practice their faith.
You know, I think there's a lot of things that are like that, though, in Cuba, that, you know, the official stance is to not support it or to be in opposition of it, but maybe not to actively work against it. You know, I know your caller was talking a few minutes ago about Cubans being very well up on American politics and what's going on here, and they have one of the things we learned on the trip was this extensive underground information network, you know, that Cuba has, where they basically, you know, a group of people download a bunch of stuff from the internet and then distribute it across the island weekly. Hmm. And the government knows it's happening, but they also know that they could not put, you know, they don't have the resources to provide something in place of that should they really want to shut that down. And so they allow it to go on, or they don't get in the way of it going on. And I think to some degree that might be an attitude similar to what's going on with the faith. You know, we're not going to support it, and we'll speak out against it, but we're not going to maybe necessarily try to eradicate it. Though, again, I'm not as informed on that subject as I'd like to be.
You know, so I'm talking to you today. You're in Michigan, right? And you teach
yes.
there?
I do. Mm-hmm.
But you also run this writing workshop that you and your wife, who's also a novelist, mm-hmm. run in Nevada. Is
yes.
that right? For young writers? I mean, like high
for
school age?
Yeah, high school age, 14 to 18, yep.
What do your young writers want to write about?
Oh, everything. They're wonderful. I mean, we go out. So this is, we started this, my wife and I, about four or five years ago. We had both gotten to teach at a couple young writers' camps around the country, and the experience was great, and we really loved giving that opportunity to, you know, students that age, but they were also very expensive. And my wife and I often lamented, you know, she's from a less privileged rural background in Nevada, and, you know, she'd often say, you know, I would have loved something like this as a kid. Of course, like, we could never afford it. We could never have sent me to something like this. And so, you know, we eventually put all the pieces together and realized we could just start our own camp and go back to Pahrump, Nevada, where she's from, and offer it to the students there for free. So, you know, it's just they love everything. Some of them are really into literary fiction. Some of them love Harry Potter. Some of them want to write fan fiction for The Mockingbird, you know, that book series. And it's all great. You know, it's just it ends up being just a great week where they get to experiment with a kind of writing that I think we don't often give students or young folk a space to do.
So I always wonder about, when a student comes in with a pretty different perspective on what they want to write, how you guide that kind of creative writing without getting in the way of it?
You know, I think you just, first and foremost, and I try to tell this to my students early on, you know, I'm going to treat your work as seriously as you treat it, you know. And so when students bring in a manuscript that it's clear they've spent a lot of time on, they've thought about, it makes it very easy, regardless of the material or what genre it might eventually get put into, to sort of just engage with it and ask questions about their characters and why they made certain decisions and other possibilities for the manuscript that I might see that they may not be seeing at the moment. So, you know, I've been lucky that it hasn't been an issue yet, and it's just... they're so young and they're just starting out. It's all of it is just so much about dealing with possibilities and taking that, you know, trying to capitalize on possibilities that it makes it very easy.
Can I ask you how old you are?
I am 33.
Okay. So what do you know about writing that perhaps you wouldn't even tell these young students, but that, you know, this is knowledge that you've acquired that they will at some point know too. I mean, what do you know that maybe you might have wanted to know at the beginning or maybe not? I don't know. What do you think?
I would say you sort of have to adjust your idea of time if you're going to be a writer, and you have to start thinking in much bigger chunks. You know, when I was in grad school, you know, there's such a push and you're trying to get, you know, you're starting to write and you're starting to write well, you know, hopefully for the first time in your life and getting some publications. And then you're like, oh, I'm going to finish this book and I'm going to publish it. And, you know, book, you know, from the day I sat down to write the book to when it came out was a little bit over 5 years. And so once the book came out, I started thinking about that and reflecting on how much time had gone into it. And I found it very sort of relaxing to be like, oh, okay, I don't actually need to write a book in the next year. I'll have like 5 years. And just sort of giving yourself, you know, the space to know or letting yourself understand that it's going to take a large chunk of time, and that's a really, really good thing, and that lets you slow down a little bit and really hopefully make newer and better work every day.
You know, that's so – you know that that's kind of counter to where the publishing – and your editor would probably pull her hair out or his hair out if he heard you saying, and I relaxed and I thought, hey, I've got another 5 years. All right. Because the publishing industry looks at a great novel like this and the attention that it's getting and says, bring me more. Right.
I have had a great experience with Tim over at Tim Dugan Books, and he has been nothing but supportive. So I think he's fortunate enough maybe lucky for me to wait for the best work I can offer him. So, you know, I'm very lucky. I don't feel the pressure yet.
Okay. Well, I hope I didn't apply it, but I know, you know, how that's kind of how the business of it works. It sounds like you may not have to be influenced by that, which is really nice.
Hopefully not. Yeah. But who doesn't read a book they love and then says, okay, when are they going to write another
one?
When are you going to get my hands on this thing again?
Yes. Derek, what's coming next, right? So we're going to close with some music. This is actually some music that I heard when we were in Cuba. And then when I went on YouTube, I realized that she is very popular. I felt like I had just discovered this, but I had. Do you know who Denay Suarez is?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Well, I hope you'll enjoy this music because she's fantastic. And the book and the song is called Yo Apredni. And the book is called The Mortifications. Derek, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.